Diddy started one of the most successful rap labels of the 90s and discovered a lot of legendary artists. It made him one of the most powerful dudes in the entertainment industry. But what people didn't know about were the brutal crimes he was committing behind the scenes. And now he's looking at spending the rest of his life in prison after hundreds of victims have come forward. From starting Bad Boy Records and taking over the game, to getting arrested by the feds, this is the full story and downfall of Diddy. Sean Combs, aka P. Diddy, was born in Harlem, New York on November 4th, 1969. Diddy's dad, Melvin Earl Combs, was a well-known drug dealer in Harlem who had ties to Frank Lucas. Frank Lucas was a kingpin who ran a major heroin ring in Harlem in the 60s and 70s. His life inspired the movie American Gangster, starring Denzel Washington. Frank Lucas was known for selling a type of heroin he called Blue Magic that was 98 to 100% pure, and he allegedly made over $50 million before he was convicted of drug trafficking in 1976 and sentenced to 70 years in prison. Diddy's dad, Melvin, had ties to Frank Lucas and ran his own crew in Harlem. But in 1972, when Diddy was 3 years old, Melvin was murdered during a drug deal gone wrong because the dealer thought he was an informant. So Diddy was mainly raised by his mom, Janice. Janice worked two or three jobs as a model and teacher's assistant so she could provide a better life for Diddy and his sister, Keisha. When Diddy was 12 years old, Janice moved the family out to a suburb of New York called Mount Vernon because she wanted to keep Diddy out of the streets so he wouldn't go down like his dad. But even though they left Harlem, Janice still struggled to support the family and they were pretty poor. Diddy graduated from Mount St. Michael Academy, a Catholic school in the Bronx. After high school, he went to Howard University in Washington, D.C. to study business. Diddy always knew he wanted to be successful, but didn't want to turn to the streets like his dad. While he was in college, Diddy started a few different side businesses, hosting parties, and running a shuttle to the airport. Diddy started to realize that college wasn't going to take him where he needed to go, and decided he wanted to make a name for himself in the music industry. So he dropped out of Howard after his second year to work as an intern at Uptown Records. Uptown Records had a major buzz in hip-hop and R&B at the time, and already had a few big acts like Heavy D and Jodeci. Diddy grew up near Heavy D in Mount Vernon, so he already had a connection. Diddy convinced Heavy D to introduce him to Uptown's founder, Andre Harrell, and that's how Diddy landed an internship. Diddy would take the train to New York City to be at the internship while he was still in school. He was so broke that he used to hide in the bathroom while the conductor was coming through because he couldn't afford the ticket. Eventually, Diddy realized that he couldn't keep up with the classes and his internship, so he dropped out of Howard and went to work at Uptown full-time. Andre Harrell recognized Diddy's talent, so he started teaching him how the game worked. Diddy worked his way up at the company and got promoted to a talent director. And that's when he started working with major acts like Mary J. Blige and Jodeci and was a big part in developing their careers. While Diddy was working at Uptown, he also started dating a fashion designer named Misa Hilton. They both grew up in Mount Vernon and Diddy lived near one of Misa's childhood friends, so they already had a connection and hit it off right away. They helped each other out a lot early on in their careers, and Diddy helped Misa get her first big break as a stylist for artists on the Uptown like Jodeci and Biggie Smalls. Misa gave birth to Diddy's first son, Justin, in December 1993, but their relationship didn't last and they broke up. It seemed like they stayed close over the years though, and Misa even attended Diddy's 50th birthday party in 2019. But like a lot of Diddy's relationships, it seems like there might have been more going on behind the scenes. In 2023, Justin was arrested for a DUI, and Misa hopped on social media and aired Diddy out for being a bad influence. On her Instagram story, Misa wrote, "Everyone has to sit around for years and act like there isn't something wrong with you. This is where the buck stops for me." She also seemed to blame Diddy for Justin being an alcoholic and talked about his relationship with Ciroc and a lawsuit he filed against another liquor company for racial discrimination. Misa wrote, "How you go from one of the greatest to ever do it to making all your money off alcohol and suing a damn alcohol company? Sell something healthy that builds people up. I'm sick of it, not mine." It also seems like Diddy may have been abusive while they were together. In 2024, after a video came out showing Diddy abusing his ex-girlfriend Cassie, Misa wrote an Instagram post, "I am heartbroken that Cassie must relive the horror of her abuse, and my heart goes out to her. I know exactly how she feels, and through my empathy, it has triggered my own trauma." Misa didn't say directly that Diddy was abusive to her, but after everything that's come out, it wouldn't be that shocking. After Diddy broke up with Misa, he started dating a model named Kim Porter. They first met after Kim came to the studio with her ex-husband, singer Al B. Short. Kim started working at Uptown Records as a receptionist and immediately hit it off with Diddy. They started dating not long after, and Diddy even helped her raise her son Quincy, who she had with Al B. Short while they were still together. Kim and Diddy dated on and off for about 13 years and had three kids together, a son named Christian and two daughters, Jessie and Delilah. But even though it seemed like Kim and Diddy were soulmates, it turns out they had a pretty toxic relationship that wasn't revealed until after Kim tragically died. Around the same time Diddy got with Kim, he also started throwing parties at a hip-hop club in New York called the Red Zone. Diddy knew how to make people think whatever he was doing was the coolest, most exclusive thing going on. Everyone wanted to be at his parties, and he became a big name in the New York nightlife scene. But from the very beginning, there were rumors that Diddy had a dark side and that he used his influence to abuse women. In 1990, Diddy met a woman named Joy Dickerson Neal after they were both in a music video together. Joy was a student at Syracuse University, but also worked as a location scout in the music and film industry. She first met Diddy on the set of the music video for Straight From The Soul by Finesse and Cinquez that they were both in. Joy claims that Diddy asked her out that day, but she turned him down because she heard rumors that he had a bad reputation with women. But Diddy kept trying, and Joy eventually agreed to go out with him. According to a lawsuit Joy later filed, Diddy sexually assaulted her on their first date. Joy says that she was afraid to be alone with Diddy, so she told him they could have dinner at the restaurant where she worked. While they were having dinner, Diddy allegedly spiked her drink and pressured Joy into taking a hit from a blunt. After that, Joy claims that her legs started to feel rubbery, and Diddy took her to a nearby home where he assaulted her. She also claims that he filmed the attack and showed it to other people to brag about it. Not long after Joy filed her lawsuit, another woman named Lisa Gardner came forward, accusing Diddy of taking advantage of her around the same time. Lisa claims that in 1990, when she was 16, she and a friend went to meet Diddy and the singer Aaron Hall at an event for MCA Records in Manhattan. Even though they were both underage, Lisa claims the men were feeding them drinks and putting their hands on them all night. They allegedly brought the girls back to Hall's house in New Jersey, but they were forced to drink more alcohol. According to Lisa, Diddy then tried to have sex with her, even though she was telling him to stop. When they were done, she claims that Aaron Hall also came into the room and assaulted her. Lisa says that Diddy got angry and thought she and her friend were going to tell his girlfriend what happened, so he allegedly showed up at the place Lisa was staying and choked her until she almost passed out. At the time, Diddy was able to keep things quiet because of his status and connections in the music industry. It wasn't until years later when everything started to come out about him that the world found out how long he's been accused of abusing women. But even though Diddy was able to cover up the alleged assaults, his career almost ended when he hosted an event where 9 people were killed in a stampede. On December 28, 1991, Diddy and Heavy D hosted a celebrity basketball game at City College. Legends like Run-DMC, Big Daddy Kane, and Boyz II Men were playing, and Diddy had built up a lot of hype for the event. The gym was only big enough to handle about 2,700 people, but over 5,000 showed up that night. There were only 1,200 tickets being sold at the door, and there were 2 lines set up, one for people who already bought tickets and one for everyone else. The crowd started getting angry because there was only 1 door for everyone to get checked in, which made the process slow. There were a few small fights in the crowd while people were trying to get inside, and by the time the game started, the situation was already getting dangerous. The organizers started to shut the doors, so the people outside tried to rush and get in. The gym was in the basement, down a set of stairs from the lobby. So as people tried to rush into the gym, it caused a stampede where people were pushing each other down the stairs and through glass windows, leading to a surge at the gym door. The organizers shut the doors inside the gym to keep people from getting inside, but that caused the people right outside the door to get slammed up against the wall or trampled as the crowd at the top of the stairs kept pushing to get inside. People were passing out, fainting, and getting trampled. The whole thing was going on for about 15 minutes while the game was still happening. When it finally opened the doors, some of the people on the other side had already been crushed to death. Someone announced over the intercom that the game was canceled because 3 people had already died, which caused another stampede of fans trying to get out of the gym. By the time everyone made it out, 9 people were killed and 29 others had been injured. Diddy was still fairly unknown at the time, but the stampede made national headlines. Diddy claimed that he tried to hire the NYPD to provide security for the event and said he personally tried giving victims CPR, but a report from the mayor's office found Diddy responsible. They claimed that he hired inexperienced staff and overpromoted the event, which is why so many people showed up without a ticket. No criminal charges were filed, but Diddy had to settle out of court with a lot of the victims. During that time, things weren't looking great for Diddy's career. He was dealing with all kinds of legal problems from the stampede, and people were pressuring Andre Harrell to fire him from Uptown. Some of the other executives thought Diddy was too full of himself and thought he was bringing drama to the label. After the situation died down, Diddy went back to work though. In 1992, he produced Mary J. Blige's album, What's the 411, which was a major success. The same year, he also signed a rapper from Brooklyn named Biggie Smalls. Diddy discovered Biggie after reading a story about him in the unsigned hype section of The Source magazine. Diddy arranged for a meeting with Biggie and they met up at a restaurant in Harlem called Sylvia's. Sylvia's was known for having some of the best soul food in the world, but when Diddy asked Biggie what he wanted to eat, Biggie said he wasn't hungry. Diddy realized Biggie knew what a big moment this was and was so excited about the opportunity that he wasn't even hungry. Diddy could tell how bad Biggie wanted to be a star, and Diddy knew right away they needed to sign him. The only problem was, Diddy's career at Uptown Records was still on the rocks. Even though Diddy knew how to make hit records, he also made a lot of enemies. The other executives at Uptown hated him and started putting pressure on Andre Harrell to let him go. Diddy wouldn't listen to anyone except Andre. But Andre started branching out into movies and TV and didn't have time to get involved whenever Diddy got into an argument with someone. Managing Diddy was starting to become a full-time job, and Andre didn't have the patience to keep up. The final straw came when Diddy brought Biggie to the label and started working on his first album, Ready to Die. Executives at MCA Records, another label that was partnered with Uptown, didn't like Biggie's music because it was too violent and street-oriented. MCA didn't want to release the album, but Andre knew Diddy wasn't going to be happy. Andre saw Diddy's vision and knew that music was changing. Dr. Dre's album The Chronic had just dropped, and gangster rap was taking over the country. Andre didn't want to tell Diddy and Biggie how to make music, but he also didn't have time to get everyone else on board. So Andre decided to fire Diddy from Uptown so he could figure it out on his own. Getting fired from Uptown was a huge loss for Diddy, and he spent a few days crying and trying to figure out the next move in his career. But a few weeks later, Diddy got a $10 million deal with Arista Records to start his own label, Bad Boy Records. Biggie Smalls was the first artist signed to Bad Boy, and Diddy got to work finding new artists to bring to the label. The next rapper Diddy signed was Craig Mack. Craig Mack was working as a roadie for the group EPMD. Through some mutual friends, Craig Mack got the opportunity to freestyle for Diddy, and Diddy liked it so much, he made a deal with Craig on the spot. Craig Mack's single, Flavor in Your Ear, was the first single that Bad Boy dropped. The song was a big hit and peaked at number 9 on the Billboard chart. Then Biggie hopped on a remix with LL Cool J, Rampage, and Busta Rhymes, which built more hype for Craig Mack and Bad Boy. The same year, Biggie also had a major hit when he dropped Juicy, the lead single from his album. The song made it to number 27 on the Billboard chart and is now considered one of the greatest rap songs of all time. Biggie followed up by dropping Ready to Die in September 1994, which was a massive hit and peaked at number 15 on the Billboard chart. People were already calling it an instant classic and made Biggie an overnight superstar. Craig Mack also dropped his album, Project Funk the World. It ran up decent numbers, but it didn't quite live up to the hype around Ready to Die. And from there, Craig Mack's career would start to go downhill. Diddy said in interviews that they were working on Craig Mack's second album, but Craig Mack ended up leaving Bad Boy in 1996 and dropped a second project, Operation Get Down, on a different label in 97. By that point, he lost a lot of his buzz, and Craig didn't drop another project for 20 years. After that, he pretty much disappeared from the music industry. But out of nowhere around 2012, Craig appeared in a YouTube video telling fans he joined a Christian ministry. Fans found out that Craig Mack was part of the Overcomer Ministry in South Carolina, which some people say is a cult and run by a dude named Brother Sinclair, who's been accused of crimes like assault and sexual conduct with a minor. Craig Mack self-released one final album in 2017 called The Mack World Sessions. But a few months later in March 2018, it was announced that Craig Mack had died from heart failure and other complications from HIV/AIDS. Like a lot of artists that signed the Bad Boy, Craig Mack had a pretty tragic life after he left the label. Some fans even accused Diddy of wrecking Craig Mack's career on purpose once he realized that he didn't have as much potential as other artists on the label. Even though Craig Mack's album didn't sell as much as Biggie's, the success of both projects proved that Bad Boy was on the come up and Diddy knew how to build a label. It started out pretty rocky, and no one knew what was going to happen after Diddy was fired from Uptown. But in under a year, the label had already dropped multiple hit singles and released a classic album. Over the next few years, Bad Boy became the top label for upcoming rap and R&B artists, and Diddy started signing new talent like Faith Evans, 112, and Total. But as Diddy became more successful, his ego also started to grow, and there were more allegations about his violence and abuse of women. Diddy's former business partner, Kirk Burrows, claims he saw Diddy attack a woman inside the Bad Boy offices in 94. An ex-employee also told Rolling Stone that they had to pull Diddy off the victim after they heard screams and the sound of shattering glass. A former intern at Arista named April Lampos claimed in a lawsuit that in the mid-90s, Diddy attacked her multiple times, including once forcing her to give him oral sex in a parking garage. She also said that Diddy allegedly forced her to take ecstasy and have sex with him and his then-girlfriend, Kim Porter. At the time, Diddy was one of the hottest music producers in the world and used his influence in the industry to keep the news from getting out. At the same time, Bad Boy Records was about to get a lot more publicity after they started beefing with Tupac and Death Row Records. At first, there was no beef between Biggie and Tupac, and they were all cool. Biggie was a huge fan of Tupac when he was first coming in the game, and Tupac was bumping Biggie's first single, Party and Bullshit, for weeks after he first heard it. Before Ready to Die dropped and Biggie really blew up, Diddy had phoned him out to LA to do promo for the album. Biggie bought some weed from a dealer who knew Tupac and convinced the dude to connect them. When Biggie and Tupac first met, they hit it off from the jump and became friends. When Tupac was in New York, he would hang out with Biggie and his crew, Junior Mafia, and Pac even brought them out on stage at a few of his shows. At one point, Biggie even wanted Tupac to be his manager because Diddy was still trying to get Bad Boy off the ground and didn't have much money to give him. Tupac was already a big name, and Biggie was still in the streets and wanted to make it in the rap game like Pac did. But Tupac convinced Biggie that Diddy would make him rich. Biggie and Pac were tight back then, but that all changed after Tupac was set up and robbed at a studio in New York. In 1994, Tupac was going through some legal problems after he was accused of sexually assaulting a woman named Ayanna Jackson. It was a huge case, and Tupac had some serious legal bills, so he was trying to work as much as possible to pay his lawyers. The night before the final day of the trial, Tupac was working on some verses for a rapper named Ron G when he got a message from a dude named Jimmy Henchman. Jimmy Henchman was a drug kingpin from Brooklyn who started a management company called Caesar Entertainment and had ties to another big-time drug dealer named Haitian Jack, who was one of Tupac's co-defendants on a sexual assault case. Jimmy Henchman wanted Tupac to go to Quad Studios in Times Square to do a feature for his artist Lil Sean. Tupac was suspicious, but Jimmy Henchman was offering $7,000 and he needed the money. So Tupac agreed and went to the studio with his homie Stretch and a few other people. Right as they were walking in the building, they heard someone yelling to them from a few stories up. They realized that it was Lil C's and some other dudes from Junior Mafia, which meant Biggie and Diddy were also in the building. But Tupac never even made it to the studio because he was stopped in the lobby by three armed robbers. They demanded Tupac give up his jewelry. Pac wasn't about to give it up though, so they beat him up and shot him 5 times. Tupac was rushed to the hospital and had to get immediate surgery. He checked himself out a few hours later against the doctor's orders and showed up to the hearing of his trial bandaged up and in a wheelchair. Tupac was found not guilty of the most serious charges, but was found guilty of 2 counts of sexual abuse and sentenced to 18 months to 4 years in prison. His lawyer filed an appeal, but his bail was set at $3 million. Tupac couldn't afford it, which meant he had to stay locked up while they worked on the case. Tupac knew what happened at Quad Studios wasn't just a random robbery, it was a setup. He blamed Jimmy Henchman, but Tupac was also convinced that Biggie and Diddy were in on it because they were there that night. But what really made Pac think Biggie was involved was when he dropped the track Who Shot Ya and rapped, "Separate the weak from the obsolete. Hearts are creeped in Brooklyn streets. It's on, nigga. Fuck all that bickering beef. I can hear sweat trickling down your cheek. Your heartbeat sound like Sasquatch feet, thundering, shaking the concrete." The song could have been about anyone, but Tupac was convinced it was a diss about him and confirmed that Biggie was the one who set him up. Biggie and Diddy both denied having anything to do with Tupac getting shot, but Pac didn't believe him. While Tupac was serving his sentence, Suge Knight was on the lookout for new talent to sign to Death Row Records. Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg would put Death Row on the map with The Chronic and Doggy Style, but none of the other artists on the label were blowing up and becoming superstars. Suge knew he needed another big name and thought Tupac would be perfect. Tupac heard that Suge Knight was interested in signing him, so he reached out to ask for help. Tupac still couldn't afford bail, and his mom's house was about to go into foreclosure. So Tupac asked his new wife, Keisha Morris, to get in contact with Suge Knight about a deal. They ended up getting on the phone, and later the same day, Suge sent Tupac $15,000 to save his mom's home. Then Suge flew to Clinton Correctional Facility, where Tupac was locked up, and offered him a 3-album deal with Death Row, which would give him the money he needed to get out of prison. So Tupac had no choice but to accept the deal with Suge. During the meeting, Tupac told Suge all about the shooting at Quad Studios and his theory that he was set up by Biggie and Diddy. Tupac told Suge that if he signed a Death Row, Suge had to have his back and go after Diddy for him, because Pac wanted to destroy Bad Boy Records. The same day, Suge left the prison and flew down to New York City to go to the 1995 Source Awards at Madison Square Garden. Death Row won the award for Soundtrack of the Year for the movie Above the Rim. Suge went on stage to accept the award and made a speech that basically started the East Coast-West Coast beef. In his speech, Suge made fun of Diddy for ad-libbing on tracks and dancing in music videos. Suge invited any artist who didn't want the producer all up in their videos to come sign with Death Row. Even though he didn't mention Diddy by name, it was pretty clear who he was talking about, and that's what sparked the beef between Bad Boy Records and Death Row. It didn't take long for things to get violent. A few weeks later, Diddy and Suge were both in Atlanta for Jermaine Dupri's birthday party. Their crews ended up getting into a fight outside and shots were fired. Jake Robles, a member of the Mob Power Rules and Death Row employee who worked as Suge's bodyguard, ended up getting killed. No one knows exactly who pulled the trigger, but multiple witnesses, including Jermaine Dupri, said it was Diddy's bodyguard. Suge immediately blamed Diddy, which made the beef even more personal. In 2003, Diddy's former business partner, Kirk Burrows, claimed that Diddy had approved the murder of Jake Robles and that a local sheriff who later died in a car accident identified Diddy's bodyguard, Anthony Wolf Jones, as a shooter. Although another one of Diddy's former bodyguards, Gene Deal, claims this was all cap and that the murder had nothing to do with Diddy. Gene said in an interview that the same night, Suge had also slapped Jermaine Dupri, who was upstairs hiding when Jake was shot. Gene also said that the real killer was a dude named Jason, who was mad that Suge and Jake were talking crazy to his girl. According to Gene, everyone depended on Wolf to try and hype up the East Coast-West Coast beef. although Gene also admitted he wasn't around at the time and that's just what he heard. No one really knows who killed Jake Robles, but Suge blamed it on Diddy and it made the beef even worse. Not long after Suge's homie got killed, Tupac signed his deal with Death Row and finally posted bail. Once Tupac got out, he started working on his next album. While the East Coast-West Coast beef was heating up, Diddy kept growing Bad Boy Records, and in 1996, he signed Mace and the Lox to the label. Mace had already built a buzz in Harlem after forming a group called Children of the Corn with his childhood friend Cameron and a bunch of other Harlem rappers, including Big L. After Children of the Corn broke up, Mace decided to go solo. His sister introduced him to a dude named Cutta Love, who was Biggie's road manager. Cutta Love took Mace to a rap convention in Atlanta to meet Diddy. At the convention, Mace spit a freestyle. Diddy was so impressed, he offered him $250,000 to sign with Bad Boy. Around the same time, Diddy discovered the Lox after hearing one of their demo tapes. The Lox was a group from Yonkers made up of Jadakiss, Styles P, and Sheik Louch. The Lox had done a record with Jazzo, a rapper and producer known for mentoring Jay-Z. It was an underground hit in New York, and Mary J. Blige heard it and became a big fan of the Lox. She passed their tape along to Diddy, who offered them a deal with Bad Boy. Mace and the Lox joined Bad Boy right at the time that the East Coast-West Coast beef was getting serious. A few months after Tupac got out of jail, he dropped the legendary diss track, Hit 'Em Up, where he responded to Who Shot Ya by dissing Biggie and the rest of Bad Boy. On the song, Tupac raps, "First off, fuck your bitch and the clique you claim. West side when we ride, come equipped with game. You claim to be a player, but I fucked your wife. We bust on Bad Boys, niggas fuck for life. Plus, Puffy trying to see me, weak hearts I rip. Biggie Smalls and Junior Mafia some mark-ass bitches." Pac claimed that he had sex with Biggie's wife, Faith Evans. Faith was a singer signed to Bad Boy Records, and Pac had paid her to go out to California to record a verse for his album. Faith didn't know that Pac was signed to Death Row at the time, but when she asked Biggie if he was okay with it, he told her to go get the money. So Faith flew out to LA to record, which is when Tupac claims they hooked up. Faith denies that she actually slept with Tupac, although she admits that he tried to get her to give him head in his hotel room while giving her money for the feature. After that, Faith realized that Tupac was only using her to get back at Biggie. There's another wild theory going around that Tupac also slept with Diddy's girlfriend, Kim Porter, and that Diddy was in on it. In 2024, a guy named Chris Todd published a book called Kim's Lost Words, A Journey for Justice from the Other Side on Amazon, which was supposed to be a bunch of diary entries Kim had written before she died and saved on a flash drive. The book had all kinds of wild stories about Diddy, and people started buying it like crazy. In one of the chapters, Kim allegedly claimed that she and Diddy were in an open relationship and she hooked up with Tupac. When Diddy found out about it, he suggested that they all have a threesome, but Tupac shut it down because he wasn't gay. Diddy kept trying to make it happen, which made Tupac really uncomfortable, and from then on, they hated each other. So when Tupac bragged about smashing his girl on Hit 'Em Up, Diddy was furious, which may have been a part of the reason he wanted Tupac killed. It's only a theory, and Kim's family has said that the book is fake, but based on all the other stories about Diddy, it doesn't sound that hard to believe. On the outro, Tupac let it be known he wanted to smoke with anyone affiliated with Bad Boy and said, "Fuck Mobb Deep, fuck Biggie, fuck Bad Boy as a staff, record label, and as a motherfucking crew. And if you want to be down with Bad Boy, then fuck you too." Hit 'Em Up was one of the most savage diss tracks ever, and might have been the reason Tupac was killed only 3 months later. On September 7th, 1996, Tupac and Suge Knight were leaving the MGM Grand in Las Vegas when a car pulled up next to him at a stoplight and started letting off shots. They were both hit, but Suge survived, while Tupac was pronounced dead at the hospital a few days later. To this day, no one knows exactly what happened, but one of the main theories was that it was connected to the East Coast-West Coast beef. In 2023, police arrested a dude named Keefe D, who claims he was in the car with Tupac's killer the night of the murder. For years, Keefe D had been claiming in interviews that Diddy offered him $1 million to kill Tupac or Suge Knight. Keefe D was a member of the Compton Crips and the uncle of Orlando Baby Lane Anderson, the main suspect in Tupac's murder. Baby Lane was also a Crip who had beef with a few Bloods who were connected to Death Row. Right before Tupac was murdered, Baby Lane had been jumped by Suge Knight, Tupac, and a few other Death Row affiliates when they spotted him in the lobby of the MGM Grand Hotel after the Mike Tyson fight. According to Keefe D, Diddy had already offered the Compton Crips $1 million to kill Suge Knight and Tupac. So after the fight at the MGM Grand, they decided to go through with it and follow Suge and Tupac until they had a clear shot. In a recorded interview with a former LAPD officer, Keefe D said it was Baby Lane who fired the shots that killed Tupac. Keefe D had been on record claiming that Diddy was the one who put out the hit since at least 2008. But for years, the case was unsolved. It wasn't until all the other accusations about Diddy started to come out that Keefe D was finally arrested and charged with Tupac's murder. But by that point, Baby Lane had already been dead for years after he was killed in an unrelated gang shooting in 1998. Tupac's death was the beginning of the end for Death Row Records. Suge was arrested for a probation violation for jumping Baby Lane the night of the murder and got sentenced to 9 years in prison. But that still wasn't the end of the East Coast-West Coast beef. On March 9, 1997, Biggie was murdered while leaving a party in Hollywood Hills. Biggie was in a black SUV with Lil Cease and other members of Junior Mafia, and Diddy was in the car behind them. While they were stopped at a red light, a Chevy Impala pulled up at the stoplight next to the car Biggie was in. The driver rolled down the window and started letting off shots from a 9mm pistol. Biggie was hit 4 times and ended up dying at the hospital. Biggie's murder is also still unsolved, but most people thought it was part of the East Coast-West Coast beef and payback for Tupac's death. Greg Kading, the same LAPD officer who interviewed Keefe D about his involvement in Tupac's murder, claimed that Biggie was killed by Wardell Poochie Foose, a Mob Pow Rule member with ties to Suge Knight. Although there's another theory that Diddy may have also been behind Biggie's murder. Multiple people told Rolling Stone that right before his death, Biggie was trying to leave Bad Boy Records. At the time of his murder, Biggie was in a legal battle with the label over the rights to his music. According to one music executive, when Biggie tried to take back the rights to his publishing, Diddy told the lawyers, "I will never give it up until I'm dead and my bones are crushing the powder." So one theory is that Diddy decided to take out Biggie before he could leave Bad Boy and stage it to look like it was payback for Tupac. There's no evidence that Diddy was involved, but after everything else has come out about him, anything is possible. Biggie's second album, Life After Death, came out 16 days after he died. It was a huge hit and debuted at number 1 on Billboard after selling close to 700,000 copies the first week. It was full of features from other Bad Boy artists like Mace, The Lox, and even Diddy himself. A few months earlier, Diddy had made his debut as a rapper under the name Puff Daddy. He dropped a single called Can't Nobody Hold Me Down, which spent 28 weeks on the Billboard chart. Later that same year, Diddy dropped his debut album, No Way Out, which had multiple features from Biggie and other Bad Boy artists like Mace, The Lox, 112, and Faith Evans. No Way Out was another big hit for Bad Boy and spent a few weeks at the top of the Billboard charts. It even won a Grammy that year for Best Rap Album. With Biggie gone, Diddy continued to promote the other artists on the label. Mace dropped his debut album, Harlem World, in October 97, which also did big numbers and eventually went quadruple platinum after selling close to 5 million copies. In 98, The Lox dropped their album, Money, Power, Respects, which peaked at number 3 on the Billboard chart and is now considered a classic hip-hop album. Around the same time, Diddy also started hosting his famous all-white parties in the Hamptons. From music industry execs to celebrities and sports team owners, anyone who was rich and famous would end up going to Diddy's parties. But there were also a lot of sketchy things going on at those parties, and that's where a lot of Diddy's alleged crimes happened. Bad Boy is one of the most successful hip-hop labels of all time, but by the late 90s, things started to fall apart. Even though Diddy made them all stars, no one liked working with him, and all of his artists started to leave the label. The Lox left Bad Boy in 1999 and signed to DMX's Rough Riders Entertainment. By that time, Bad Boy was known for having a more pop and R&B style, which they felt didn't match their hardcore sound. The Lox felt like Rough Riders would be a better fit, but Diddy wouldn't let them out of their contract. It wasn't until they got in a heated argument and Styles P threw a chair at Diddy that he finally let them go. Mace left Bad Boy the same year after dropping his second album, Double Up. In an interview with Funkmaster Flex a few months before the project dropped, Mace shocked the world by announcing he was leaving the music industry to follow God and become a minister. Mace said that the rap industry wasn't real and he wanted to do something that made him happy. He also later admitted that a big part of his decision to leave the music industry was to escape Diddy. Mace claims that he wrote a lot of the hits that Bad Boy was putting out at the time, including Biggie's classic record, Mo Money, Mo Problems. He'd be in the studio working on music while Diddy was out partying, but wasn't getting any money or credit for the work.
Puff would go out and party, and I would be in the studio writing the records, and then I'd just come back and say, he'll say this is his part or that is his part, but I was the person there creating it all. And even Mo Money, Mo Problems, I came up with that. I came up with the beat too. So just imagine all of these moments that are taken from you, the records, the beats, you ain't getting the money, you ain't getting the publishing, you ain't getting the respect. And I don't think you're like that.
So eventually Mace got fed up and decided to do something else with his life. Ever since then, he's had problems with Diddy, who refused to give him back the rights to his music and had taken shots at each other over the years. It wasn't just artists on Bad Boy that Diddy had problems with. He was also hit with 2 felonies after he attacked another music industry executive, Steve Stout. Steve Stout was working with Nas at the time, who had just done a song with Diddy called Hate Me Now. In the music video, there was a scene showing Nas and Diddy getting crucified. Originally, Diddy wanted to be in the scene, and Sony Records spent an extra $14,000 to make it happen. But after it was finished, Diddy started having second thoughts. Diddy's scene showed him nailed to a cross, wearing a crown of thorns like Jesus. Diddy was a Catholic, so he thought it might be a bad look. Sony didn't want to cut the scene because they'd already spent the money, so they agreed to include a disclaimer, which Diddy approved. But right before the video was ready to air on MTV, Diddy spoke with his mom and his pastor, who convinced him that they had to edit out the scene. Diddy's pastor called Steve Stout and asked him to edit the scene. According to the pastor, Steve Stout said he would make it happen. But by that point, the video had already been sent to MTV, and Steve didn't have the authority to stop it. The video ended up airing on MTV later that day, with the crucifixion scene still in it. Diddy was mad and started calling Steve Stout nonstop. Diddy was convinced that Steve Stout and the label aired it on purpose to create a controversy. But Steve Stout claims they're waiting to hear back from Diddy about what to do, but didn't get an answer in time to pull the video. However it happened, Diddy blamed Steve Stout. A few minutes later, Diddy barged into Steve Stout's office at Universal and punched him in the face. Then, Diddy and a few of his bodyguards threw Steve on the ground and beat him with a phone, a chair, and even a champagne bottle. While Steve was lying on the floor bleeding, Diddy and his crew started trashing the office. Steve had him taken to the hospital and decided to press charges against Diddy for attacking him. At first, Diddy denied it and claimed they had gotten into a fistfight, but police had enough evidence to make an arrest, and Diddy was charged with second-degree assault and criminal mischief. Diddy eventually made a public apology and settled a lawsuit with Steve out of court for $500,000. After that, Steve agreed to drop the assault charge, and Diddy pled guilty to harassment, which meant he was only sentenced to one day of anger management classes. Diddy skated on the case, but his legal problems were just getting started. After Mason and Lox left, Diddy struggled to break new talent, especially after his newest up-and-coming artist, Shine, was arrested in connection with a wild shooting at a club in New York and spent the next 9 years locked up. Shine was originally from Belize, but moved to Brooklyn when he was a kid and started rapping when he was 15. In 98, Shine was discovered by DJ Clark Kent, who heard him freestyle in a barbershop in Brooklyn. At the time, DJ Clark Kent was working on Biggie's third album, Born Again. Shine had a heavy Brooklyn accent and sounded a lot like Biggie. So DJ Clark Kent brought Shine right to the studio to meet Diddy, who signed him on the spot. Diddy must have really seen something in Shine, because he allegedly offered him a 5-album deal for over $1 million, even though Shine had never released a song. At the time, Shine was still sleeping on his mom's couch and working as a bike messenger, so he didn't think twice about taking the deal. But in the long run, it ended up ruining his life. Back then, most artists were lucky if they even got $50,000 for signing, and over $100,000 was a big deal. So Shine getting over $1 million made a lot of the other artists at Bad Boy jealous. They thought the only reason Diddy gave him that much is because Shine sounded a lot like Biggie. So now that Biggie was dead, maybe Diddy thought he could market Shine to Biggie's fans and create another star. It also didn't help that Bad Boy seemed to be having financial problems too. In 99, it was reported that Diddy had gotten a $50 million advance from Arista Records, but Bad Boy only made $30 million that year. Diddy tried to hold the label down as a solo artist, but his second album, Forever, didn't get as much attention as his first album. The fans' reaction to Shine also wasn't what they expected. Shine started featuring on songs with other Bad Boy artists, and some fans complained that he sounded too much like Biggie and was copying him. Shine never got a chance to prove he could find his own unique sound, because he ended up in prison before dropping his first album. On December 27, 1999, Shine went to a club in Manhattan with Diddy and his girlfriend at the time, Jennifer Lopez. Inside the club, Diddy had gotten into a fight with a dude from Brooklyn named Matthew Allen, aka Scar. Diddy allegedly knocked over Scar's drink, which sparked an argument. According to witnesses, Scar or one of his homies ended up throwing a wad of cash in Diddy's face. Diddy, Shine, and Scar all pulled out guns, leading to a shootout inside the club. Three innocent people ended up getting hit, including a woman named Natanya Rubin who got shot in the face. Witnesses claimed that it was Diddy and Shine who had fired the shots, and they were both chased down and arrested after running from the club. Jennifer Lopez was also arrested, but the charges against her were eventually dropped. Diddy and Shine were both hit with attempted murder and weapons charges. Diddy was also charged with attempting to bribe his driver, Wardell Fenderson, to claim it was his gun. Diddy hired big-name lawyers like Johnny Cochran, who was famous for defending other celebrities like Snoop Dogg and OJ Simpson. Even though Scar claimed that both Shine and Diddy shot at him, the focus of the case was mainly on Shine. Shine argued that he acted in self-defense and fired the shots into the air so the victims weren't hit by his bullets. A weapons expert testified that it was possible a second gunman could have been responsible for the shooting. They also testified that at least one of the injuries could have been caused by a .40 cal weapon, even though Shine fired a 9mm. But Sean only claimed that he was innocent and didn't put the blame on Diddy. In the end, Sean beat the attempted murder charge, but was found guilty of assault, reckless endangerment, and weapons charges, while Diddy skated on the whole case. While awaiting sentencing, Sean dropped his debut album, Sean, in 2000. It was pretty successful and made it to number 5 on the Billboard chart, but it got mixed reviews and a lot of fans still thought Sean was trying too hard to sound like Biggie. In 2001, Sean was sentenced to 10 years in prison for the shooting. He was eventually paroled in 2009 after serving close to 9 years, and when he got out, he was deported back to Belize. Even though Sean missed out on his music career, he was still determined to be successful. He decided to go into politics in Belize and was elected to the House of Representatives in 2020. Over the years, Sean has always said he was innocent in the shooting. He never directly blamed Diddy, but Sean claims that everyone knows he was just a fall guy. After all the news started coming out about Diddy's arrest for sex trafficking, Sean was asked about it in a press conference. Sean said,
"Let us not lose sight of what the cold hard facts are. This was not someone who I vacationed with and who he and I enjoyed this great intimate relationship of brotherhood. This is someone who destroyed my life."
Natanya Rubin, the woman who got shot in the face that night, also came forward and said that it was Diddy who shot her. According to Natanya, she was facing them when they all pulled out guns and saw Diddy fire the shot that hit her in the nose.
"I watched him fire the gun. I've said it all this time. Even the surgeon who did my surgery to take out part of the bullet fragments that was aspirating into my lungs and try to remove as many bullet fragments as possible testified in the criminal trial that while they were putting me under, I was screaming, 'Puffy, pew pew me in the face.'"
She filed a $130 million lawsuit against him in 2008, which was eventually settled out of court. Now that everything's coming out about Diddy, more people feel comfortable speaking up, but at the time, he got away with it and went on with his career like nothing happened. Even though Diddy beat the case, after that, Bad Boy Records really started to fall off. Most of the big acts had already left, and in the early 2000s, they weren't selling records like they used to, although they did have some success with a rapper named Black Rob. Black Rob had signed to Bad Boy in 1996 and was featured on a bunch of songs with other Bad Boy artists in the late 90s. Black Rob finally had a hit in 2000 when he dropped the single Whoa, which made it to number 43 on the Billboard chart. Then he followed it up with his debut album Life Story later that year, which was a big hit and sold close to 178,000 copies in the first week, landing at number 3 on the Billboard. Everyone thought Black Rob was going to be the next big star at Bad Boy, but that ended up being the peak of his career, and after that, he fell off pretty fast. He dropped his second album, The Black Rob Report, in 2005, but it was a little too late, and by then, Black Rob had already lost most of his buzz, so the album didn't sell much. Black Rob said he felt like Diddy and the label had turned their backs on him, so he went back to the streets and started robbing people to make money. He ended up catching a grand larceny charge and got sentenced to 7 years in prison in 2006. Black Rob eventually got out in 2010 and tried to make a comeback with his third album, Game Tested, Streets Approved. But it didn't save his career, and Black Rob became homeless. He also suffered from health problems after Bad Boy cut off his insurance when he left the label, and he ended up dying of a heart attack in 2021. Black Rob was the last of the OG Bad Boy artists to get any attention, so in the early 2000s, Diddy tried to make a pivot and get into TV. In 2000, Diddy started working on an MTV show, Making the Band, which helped keep him relevant even though Bad Boy was struggling. Making the Band 2 focused on a new group Diddy had put together, Bad Boys the Band. Starting with 40,000 applicants, Diddy eventually narrowed it down to 6 artists and coached them on how to become stars. The show helped bring some attention back to Bad Boy, and in 2003, Diddy signed a distribution deal with Universal Records after cutting ties with Arista Records. The first project released under the new deal with Universal was the band's debut album, Too Hot for TV, which ended up going gold after selling over 500,000 copies. The band saw some success because of the MTV show, but none of their careers really took off. In the third season, Diddy ended the group and decided to only keep 2 members on Bad Boy, Babs and Ness. Although he later signed one of the other members, Young City, to his new spinoff label, Bad Boy South, which was focused on Southern hip hop. Bad Boy South saw some success in the early 2000s after Diddy signed Memphis rap group 8-Ball and MJG. They dropped their 6th album, Living Legends, on Bad Boy South in 2004, which sold over 121,000 copies in the first week and hit number 3 on the Billboard chart. But even though Bad Boy was starting to make a comeback, Diddy was having problems with Universal. He felt like they weren't doing enough to support his artists, but Universal told Diddy he wasn't getting any more money until he started putting out more hit records. So Diddy eventually split off from Universal in 2005 and signed a deal with Warner Brothers instead. Around that time, Diddy signed a few new artists that brought the spotlight back to Bad Boy: Young Jock, Cassie, and Danity Kane. Young Jock was a rapper from Atlanta who was brought in to be the new face of Bad Boy South. He dropped his debut album, New Jock City, in 2006, which sold over 150,000 copies in the first week. It also featured the hit single, It's Going Down, which made it to number 3 on Billboard. Cassie was a singer and model who was discovered by R&B singer Ryan Leslie. Diddy heard one of Cassie's songs in the club and convinced Ryan Leslie to partner with Bad Boy to release Cassie's first project. Cassie dropped her self-titled debut album in 2006, which sold over 100,000 copies in the first week. The lead single from the album, Me and You, also made it to number 3 on Billboard and stayed in the top 40 for close to 5 months. Danity Kane was a group that Diddy created for season 3 of Making the Band. Unlike the first group we tried to put together for the show, Danity Kane was actually a big success. They dropped their debut album in 2006, which produced 2 top 10 singles and sold over 100,000 copies in the first day it was released, landing it at number 1 on Billboard. So 2006 was a major year for Bad Boy, and suddenly Diddy was back on top. He even dropped another solo project, Press Play, which was more successful than some of his previous projects as an artist and made it to number 1 on Billboard with big singles like Come To Me and Last Night. But behind the scenes, Diddy was still allegedly using his money and influence to get away with some wild crimes. A woman named Talia Graves claims that in 2001, Diddy and his bodyguard assaulted her at a music studio. Talia was 25 at the time and dated another producer who worked with Diddy at Bad Boy. According to Talia, Diddy took advantage of her after he invited her to the studio but laced her drink with some kind of drug. When she woke up, she realized she was tied up while Diddy and his bodyguard were having sex with her on a pool table. In a lawsuit she later filed, Talia said she later found out that they videotaped the whole thing and showed it to other people to humiliate her and her boyfriend. In 2003, another lawsuit claimed that Diddy, the former Bad Boy Records president Harv Pierre, and a third unnamed person assaulted a 17-year-old at a music studio in Manhattan. The same year, Diddy was accused of drugging and assaulting a 22-year-old model named Crystal McKinney at his apartment. Diddy was also allegedly beating his own artist. Another lawsuit filed by Don Richards, a singer who was part of Danity Kane, claimed she was physically and verbally abused by Diddy on the set of Making the Band. Dawn said that they were being filmed 24/7, and Diddy once made them rehearse for 48 hours straight without any breaks or meals. She and other contestants were constantly being yelled at by Diddy, which caused Dawn to suffer severe weight loss and dehydration. In the lawsuit, Dawn also claimed she was there when Diddy first met Cassie. According to Dawn, Diddy was obsessed with Cassie from the first time they met in 2005 when she was only 19 and he was 37. When they were together, Diddy was obsessed with Cassie and kept her away from everyone else in the room. Cassie signed a 10-album deal with Bad Boy in 2006, and about a year later, there were rumors Diddy and her were dating. They were spotted attending public events together, but kept the relationship quiet because of the age gap. Diddy had just broken up with his longtime girlfriend, Kim Porter, who he met while working at Uptown Records. According to a lawsuit Cassie later filed, Diddy started aggressively pursuing her after he ended things with Kim. There were rumors going around that they were dating, but they didn't confirm it until 2012 when they started going to events together. During that time, Diddy claimed he was helping Cassie with a second project, but no music ever came out. They dated for over 10 years, and during their relationship, Cassie claims that Diddy was abusing her the whole time. She claims that Diddy forced her to buy and take drugs like cocaine, ecstasy, and ketamine, and be part of his infamous freak-offs, the wild sex parties he would host at his properties. During the freak-offs, Diddy would force Cassie to have sex with male sex workers and film it. Sometimes he would join in, and other times he would just watch and pleasure himself. Outside of the freak-offs, he was also insanely jealous and would beat Cassie just for talking to other men, even when other people were around. In her lawsuit, Dawn Richards admitted that she witnessed Diddy assault Cassie multiple times. During a label dinner in 2010 that was attended by big names like Ne-Yo and Jimmy Iovine, Dawn claimed she saw Diddy punch Cassie in the stomach so hard that she doubled over and fell on the ground in pain. According to Dawn, Cassie was led out of the room and the dinner continued on. Dawn tried to talk with Cassie later that night and encouraged her to leave Diddy, but when Diddy heard her, he was furious and threatened to kill them both. Even if Cassie wanted to leave, she didn't have much of a choice. Every part of her life was being controlled by Diddy or one of his management companies. He paid for her apartment and all her living expenses. He even had access to her medical records. When Cassie started to experience memory loss and other symptoms from the drug use and constant beatings, the doctors would send the results to Diddy instead of her. His staff also knew to take Cassie to certain doctors so he could control her. But Cassie wasn't the only victim of Diddy's abuse. A dancer named Adria English claims that from 2006 to 2009, she was grooming and sex trafficking by Diddy and his employee Tamiko Thomas. Adria claimed she was hired as a dancer at Diddy's white parties in the Hamptons in Miami. At her first party, Diddy told her and the other dancers to drink from bottles that were laced with ecstasy. Adria said she wasn't forced to do anything sexual at the first party, but over time, she was forced into prostitution. Adria claims Diddy and his accomplices forced her to have sex with guests and used to make her wear a black dress, while everyone else dressed in white to mark her as a sex worker. Adria later sued Diddy and a dude named Jacob Arabov, aka Jacob the Jeweler, claiming he was one of her frequent partners and knew she was being trafficked. When Danity Kane broke up in 2009, Dawn Richards joined Diddy and R&B singer Kalena Harper to form the group Diddy Dirty Money. According to Dawn, during her time with the new group, Diddy's abuse only got worse. She claims he would often barge into her dressing room and fill her up or order her to strip down to her underwear during rehearsal. If she pushed back, Diddy would threaten to kick her out of the group and end her music career. During a rehearsal for a performance on Saturday Night Live, Diddy screamed at Dawn so loud that the staff in the lobby started getting worried. Dawn told him to stop calling them bitches, and Diddy cocked back his fist like he was about to punch her before he was restrained by a bodyguard. Dawn ran out crying and called her dad, who came to New York and threatened to call the police on Diddy. But Diddy just told Dawn's dad to think about his family and his daughter's career. After the SNL performance, Diddy warned Dawn not to call her dad unless she was in the hospital. In 2010, Diddy Dirty Money dropped their only studio album, Last Train to Paris. It sold over 100,000 copies in the first week and made it to number 7 on the Billboard charts. In the early 2010s, Bad Boy also saw some success by signing new acts like French Montana, Machine Gun Kelly, and King Los. But it was pretty clear the label was past its prime. So in 2013, Diddy announced that he was launching his new company, Revolt, a cable news network that also went into music, film, and digital media. Even though Diddy was discovering new talent and starting new business ventures, he was also making enemies in the younger generation of rappers. In 2012, Diddy allegedly blew up Kid Cudi's car after he found out Cudi had briefly dated Cassie. In her lawsuit, Cassie admits that she and Cudi were together for a short time during a rough patch in her relationship with Diddy. When Diddy found out about it, he was furious and tried attacking Cassie with a corkscrew. A few weeks later, Diddy and an accomplice allegedly cut the top off of Kid Cudi's convertible and threw a Molotov cocktail inside. Multiple witnesses testified in court that Diddy had bragged about setting the car on fire, and Cudi himself confirmed Cassie's story was true. But Kid Cudi wasn't the only one who had problems with Diddy. Not long after that, Diddy allegedly got into a fight with J. Cole over a Kendrick Lamar verse. Kendrick had just dropped his Control verse where he claimed to be the top rapper in the game and crowned himself the King of New York, even though he's from the West Coast. Diddy was apparently upset about the King of New York bar. Right after the song dropped, they were all at a VMA after party. According to rumors, Diddy tried to pour a drink on Kendrick's head. Cole jumped in to stop him, which caused him to start fighting, and Diddy allegedly threatened to slit J. Cole's throat. Some people who saw what happened claim it had nothing to do with Kendrick, but it's clear a fight did happen because J. Cole talks about it on the song Let Go My Hand, rapping, "My last scrap was with Puff Daddy, who would've thought it? I bought that nigga album in 7th grade and played it so much, you would've thought my favorite rapper was Puff. Back then, I ain't know shit. Now I know too much." So Cole is admitting that he once looked up to Diddy until he got into the industry and learned what he was really like behind the scenes. Cole and Kendrick weren't the only ones out of the big three who had issues with Diddy. About a year later, Diddy allegedly slapped Drake outside the club over a stolen beat. Drake and Diddy were both at Club Live in Miami for DJ Khaled's birthday party. As they were leaving, Drake and Diddy got into an argument in the parking lot where Diddy was heard yelling, "You will not disrespect me," before he put hands on Drake. At first, the rumor going around was that Diddy was mad at Drake for flirting with Cassie, but it turns out the real reason was even dumber. A video started going around showing Diddy dissing Drake for using a 0 to 100 beat. Apparently the producer, Boy Wonder, had given the beat to both of them. Diddy was planning on using it, but sat on it for a few months. Drake got tired of waiting and decided to use it himself. 0 to 100 ended up becoming a huge hit, and Diddy felt like Drake had disrespected him by stealing the beat. They later got on the phone and squashed the beef, but it seems like Diddy's temper was out of control. In 2015, Diddy also threatened an assaulting assistant basketball coach at UCLA for yelling at his son Justin. Diddy was at Justin's practice when the coach yelled at him for making a mistake. The coach said he didn't care if Justin's dad was there, and he would get the same treatment as anyone else on the team. After the practice, Diddy got into a huge fight with the coach and forced him out of the office while swinging a kettlebell at an intern. So Diddy's been acting crazy for a long time, but because of how rich and famous he was able to get away with it. It wasn't until Cassie finally escaped and let the world know what was really going on that people started to look into all the accusations. Cassie and Diddy finally broke up for good while Diddy was distracted by the death of his ex, Kim Porter. Diddy and Kim dated for 13 years and had 3 kids together. In 2018, Kim randomly died of pneumonia at age 47. It was pretty unexpected, and a lot of people questioned exactly what happened and whether Diddy was involved. Even though Kim never directly accused Diddy of abuse, people who knew him said they had a pretty wild relationship. One of Diddy's bodyguards said that he often saw Diddy put hands on Kim. Another source told Hot 97 that he saw Diddy hit Kim with a bottle during a fight at a club in Atlanta. Donald Trump Jr. said in an interview with DJ Academics that his ex-wife was good friends with Kim. According to Trump Jr.,
my ex-wife actually was a model in New York, and like she was really good friends with Kim Porter, who was Diddy's wife.
Yeah, the one
who died at 47 from pneumonia, and it was like,
when that happened,
she goes, something's up with that. I go, what do you mean? She's like, oh, dude, Kim used to tell me like it was a bad, like there's a lot of weird shit that I didn't even know that, like, but they were like, you know, they'd do photo shoots together or whatever. They were sort of friendly. Like they'd hang out. Like we'd see them out downtown, and like I'd hang out with her. Not so much with Diddy. I think it was already sort of over there. But like she was really afraid of him. And it
really,
yeah. Like this goes back years.
So when Trump Jr. heard Kim died, he immediately thought Diddy had something to do with it. Kim's Lost Words, the alleged memoir Kim wrote right before she died, also had tons of abuse allegations about Diddy. But there wasn't any evidence to prove it was real, and Kim's family came out and said it was all fake, which forced Amazon to take it down. Even though the book was probably fake, some people still think that Diddy had something to do with Kim's death, including her ex-husband, Al B. Short. According to Al, Kim was working on a memoir before she died. He said that she was trying to do what Cassie eventually did and expose all the terrible things Diddy had done to her and others. But before she could, Kim mysteriously died, which Al called a tragic murder. Al says he was trying to look into her death for years, but was ignored by the police. But now with all the recent allegations against Diddy, he wants there to be a new investigation. It's not clear if Kim was actually trying to expose Diddy before she died, but if she was, Cassie got the job done for her. Cassie was finally able to get away from Diddy while he was busy grieving over Kim. After they broke up, Cassie started seeing her personal trainer, Alex Fine. They ended up getting married in 2019 and had 2 daughters together. Once she was out of her toxic relationship with Diddy, she realized how badly Diddy abused her, so she decided to expose him. New York passed a law called Adult Survivors Act that allowed victims of sexual abuse to file lawsuits, even if it was past the statute of limitations. So in November 2023, Cassie files a lawsuit against Diddy, accusing him of abuse, violence, and sex trafficking during their 10-year relationship. Diddy denied the allegations, but a day later, they settled the lawsuit out of court for $30 million. The allegations were pretty shocking, but some people still thought it could have been a cash grab. But then more accusations and lawsuits against Diddy started rolling in. Diddy was forced to step down as chairman of Revolt, and tons of brands he did business with decided to cut ties. Plus, it wasn't just women coming forward, men were also making accusations about Diddy. In February 2024, a producer named Lil Rod filed his own lawsuit accusing Diddy of sexual abuse. According to Lil Rod, Diddy hired him in 2020 to work on his upcoming project, the Love album, Off the Grid. Lil Rod ended up producing 9 songs on the album and developed a close relationship with Diddy during the recording process. He started traveling with Diddy and became his videographer. But as time went on, Lil Rod claims Diddy became more and more controlling and abusive. Just like Cassie, Lil Rod claims he was drugged and forcing a sexual act against his will. He claims Diddy forced him to hire prostitutes for him and his celebrity friends. The lawsuits mention that Diddy had cameras all over his house that he used to record the famous people he hung out with committing crimes and having sex. The footage allegedly shows Diddy giving laced alcoholic drinks to minors and sex workers at his home. The lawsuit also named several other celebrities who were allegedly involved in Diddy's activities. Lil Rod claims Cuba Gooding Jr. was part of Diddy's inner circle and assaulted him on a yacht. Cuba allegedly grabbed him by the thigh near his groin and wouldn't back off until Lil Rod pushed him away. The suit also claims that Diddy brags about paying Young Miami from the City Girls to be a prostitute. Diddy and Young Miami were seeing each other at the time, so the timeline makes sense. They were first linked in 2021, but didn't officially confirm their relationship until 2022, when Diddy appeared on Young Miami's podcast, Carisha Please. Although she claims they were never officially in a relationship, even though they sometimes dated, they officially split in 2023 before all the recent allegations. On an episode of her podcast, Young Miami addressed the rumors and denied all the allegations about being a sex worker and participating in Diddy's freak-offs. Young Miami also claims that Diddy was never abusive to her, but she admits she can't speak on any of his exes because she wasn't around at that time. There was also a page in the lawsuit that claims Diddy had sex with a rapper, an R&B singer, and the producer, Stevie J. The rapper and R&B singer's names have been redacted, but a footnote about the rapper said, he's a Philadelphia rapper who dated Nicki Minaj. And another one about the R&B singer said, he performed at the Super Bowl and had a successful Vegas residency. It didn't take long for fans on the internet to figure out Meek Mill and Usher were the most likely suspects based on the description and their connection to Diddy. Usher has been pretty quiet about it, but Meek Mill quickly denied it by going on a wild Twitter rant. Lil Rah was also asking for $30 million. Things weren't looking good for Diddy, but at that point, no one really knew if it was all true or people were just looking for a quick payday. But a few months later, even more shocking evidence came out that proved at least some of the accusations were true. In May 2024, CNN released a video from March 2016 that shows Diddy attacking Cassie in the hallway of a hotel. The video shows Diddy wearing nothing but a towel, chasing Cassie down the hall at the Intercontinental Hotel in Las Vegas, then hitting and kicking her while she was laying on the ground. It also shows him dragging her by the shirt down the hallway and throwing a vase at her. The video footage perfectly matched an accusation Cassie had made against Diddy in her lawsuit. On that day, she claimed that Diddy was extremely drunk and punched her in the face, giving her a black eye. When she tried to leave, Diddy chased her into the hallway and attacked her. Diddy knew that if the footage ever got out, it could ruin his career. So according to Cassie, he paid the hotel $50,000 to give him the footage and make sure it never got out. Someone must have kept a copy because it ended up coming out anyway, but not in time to stop Diddy from continuing the abuse. Up until that point, all the stories about Diddy were just accusations and there was no direct evidence to prove he was guilty. No one knows exactly what's true and what isn't, but it's clear from the video that he was abusing Cassie. So there was enough evidence to convince more people that he's guilty. A few days later, Diddy posted a video to social media where he addressed the situation.
I was fucked up. I mean, I hit rock bottom, but I made no excuses. My behavior on that video is inexcusable. I take full responsibility for my actions in that video. Disgusted. I was disgusted then when I did it. I'm disgusted now. I went and I sought out professional help. I had to go into therapy. I'm going to rehab. Had to ask God for his mercy and grace.
After that, more and more women started coming out with accusations and filing lawsuits against Diddy, including Dawn Richards, April Lampost, and Adria English. For a while, it seemed like Diddy might even try to flee the country after police raided his homes in LA and Miami, and his private jet was spotted over the Caribbean. This time, there was way too much evidence and public backlash for Diddy to sweep it under the rug, and the feds were already working on a case against him. On September 16, 2024, Diddy was arrested by federal agents outside a hotel in New York. The next day, the case files were unsealed and showed that Diddy was being charged with racketeering, conspiracy, sex trafficking, and interstate transportation for prostitution. Police are accusing Diddy of using his business empire to commit crimes and force people into sexual acts against their will. He was also denied bail because prosecutors claim he's a flight risk and has a history of intimidating witnesses. So he was sent to jail in Brooklyn to wait for trial and put on suicide watch. The court documents also show that while police were searching Diddy's homes, they found over 1,000 bottles of baby oil. The photos and jokes about baby oil quickly became a meme, and Diddy's lawyer, Mark Agnifilio, was asked about it in an interview.
I don't think it was 1,000. I think it was a lot. I mean, there's a Costco right down the street. You know, I think Americans buy in bulk, as we know. And, you know, this is consensual adults doing what consensual adults do.
The clip ended up going viral, and Costco even came out and said that they don't sell baby oil in bulk. It turns out the truth about the baby oil might be even darker than people realize. There's rumors that it isn't even baby oil, and the bottles are actually filled with GHB, a drug that's meant to make you lose control of your muscles and pass out. So that might have been what Diddy was using at his parties to drug people. There are even rumors going around social media that Diddy has secret tunnels under his homes. One post claimed that Diddy's house in Los Angeles had an underwater tunnel that led all the way to the Playboy Mansion. Other posts said that the tunnel's connected to a mansion that once belonged to Michael Jackson. Police haven't confirmed the rumors, and some sources claim it's fake. But this story is already so crazy, it's hard to know what's real and what's fake. Since Diddy's been locked up, more and more wild allegations about him have been coming out. In October 2024, a lawyer named Tony Busby claimed that he was representing 120 different people with all credible accusations about Diddy. Tony started a hotline where people could call in and tell their story. He says they got over 3,200 calls, but after fact-checking the claims, they narrowed it down to about 120 cases they intended to file. In one of the complaints, Diddy's even accused of drugging and assaulting a 9-year-old boy who's auditioning for a role at Bad Boy. In another lawsuit, Diddy is accused of drugging and assaulting a 13-year-old girl along with other unnamed celebrities. People have been making jokes about Diddy and his wild parties for years, so it seems like his actions were an open secret in the industry. But now that all the details are starting to come out, it's making everyone question what people really knew and who was involved. Some people even think that Justin Bieber might have been one of Diddy's victims. Justin Bieber first met Diddy through Usher when he was only 15 and was still pretty new to the industry. Even though Diddy was almost 40 years old, they started spending a lot of time together. In an old interview on Jimmy Kimmel, Diddy admits that he met Justin in a strange way, but realized he was one of the most talented people he ever met. Justin starts talking about how Diddy gave him a Lamborghini, but Diddy cuts him off and said that Justin knows better than to talk about the things he does with Big Brother Puff on national television.
Got me a Lamborghini.
Oh, that's nice.
I haven't gotten it yet, though.
Yeah, I know. When is that coming, that Lamborghini? We talked about this last time.
He had the Lamborghini for a day or two, and he had access to the house, and he knows better than to be talking about the things that he does with Big Brother Puff on national television.
Around that time, Justin also uploaded a video to YouTube called Justin Bieber's 48 Hours with Diddy. In the video, Diddy jokes that he had custody over Justin and says that he can't disclose what they were doing, but it was every 15-year-old's dream.
Right now, he's having 48 hours with Diddy, him and his boy. They're having the times of their lives, like, you know, where we hanging out and what we doing. We can't really disclose, but it's definitely a 15-year-old's dream.
If that wasn't sketchy enough, a clip from a few years later showed Justin looking pretty nervous around Diddy. While they're in the studio together, Diddy starts pressing Justin about why they don't hang out as much anymore. Justin starts stuttering and admits that Diddy was trying to get in touch with him through his management, but he tries to play it off like it was because Diddy didn't have his personal number. Justin looks really uncomfortable and clearly doesn't want to be around Diddy. Now looking back on it, a lot of people think it's because he was one of Diddy's victims early in his career. Justin hasn't said anything publicly about the accusations and resurfaced clips, but a source close to him said that he's shocked and disturbed by the recent news. No one really knows how deep the conspiracy goes or how deep other celebrities and people in the industry knew about Diddy's crimes, but it looks like his past finally caught up with him, and there's way too much evidence and legit accusations for him to sweep it under the rug this time. It may take a while for the full truth to come out in court, but whatever happens, his reputation has been ruined, and he might end up spending the rest of his life behind bars.